From where I'm calling from. To Tess Gallagher, we can never know what to want because, living only one life, we can neither compare it with our previous lives nor perfect it in our lives to come. Milan Kundera, The Unbearable Lightness of Being. Boxes. My mother is packed and ready to move, but Sunday afternoon at the last minute, she calls and says for us to come eat with her. My ice box is defrosting, she tells me. I have to fry up this chicken before it rots. She says we should bring our own plates and some knives and forks. She's packed most of her dishes and kitchen things. Come on and eat with me one last time, she says. You and Jill. I hang up the phone and stand at the window for a minute longer, wishing I could figure this thing out. But I can't. So finally I turn to Jill and say, let's go to my mother's for a goodbye meal. Jill is at the table with a Sears catalog in front of her, trying to find us some curtains. But she's been listening. She makes a face. Do we have to? She says. She bends down the corner of a page and closes the catalog. She sighs. God, we've been over there to eat two or three times in this last month alone. Is she ever actually going to leave? Jill always says what's on her mind. She's 35 years old, wears her hair short, and grooms dogs for a living. Before she became a groomer, something she likes, she used to be a housewife and mother. Then all hell broke loose. Her two children were kidnapped by her first husband and taken to live in Australia. Her second husband, who drank, left her with a broken eardrum before he drove their car through a bridge into the Elwha River. He didn't have life insurance, not to mention property damage insurance. Jill had to borrow money to bury him, and then, can you beat it? She was presented with a bill for the bridge repair. Plus, she had her own medical bills. She can tell this story now. She's bounced back. But she has run out of patience with my mother. I've run out of patience, too. But I don't see my options. She's leaving day after tomorrow, I say. Hey, Jill, don't do any favors. Do you want to come with me or not? I tell her it doesn't matter to me one way or the other. I'll say she has a migraine. It's not like I've never told a lie before. I'm coming, she says. And like that, she gets up and goes into the bathroom where she likes to pout. We've been together since last August, about the time my mother picked to move up here to Longview from California. Jill tried to make the best of it, but my mother pulling into town just when we were trying to get our act together was nothing either of us had bargained for. Jill said it reminded her of the situation with her first husband's mother. She was a clinger, Jill said. You know what I mean? I thought I was going to suffocate. It's fair to say that my mother sees Jill as an intruder. As far as she's concerned, Jill is just another girl in a series of girls who have appeared in my life since my wife left me. Someone, to her mind, likely to take away affection, attention, maybe even some money that might otherwise come to her. But someone deserving of respect? No way. I remember, how can I forget it? She called my wife a whore before we married, and then called her a whore 15 years later after she left me for someone else. Jill and my mother act friendly enough when they find themselves together. They hug each other when they say hello or goodbye. They talk about shopping specials. But Jill dreads the time she has to spend in my mother's company. She claims my mother bums her out. She says my mother is negative about everything and everybody and ought to find an outlet, like other people in her age bracket. Crocheting, maybe, or card games at the Senior Citizens Center, or else going to church. Something, anyway, so that she'll leave us in peace. But my mother had her own way of solving things. She announced she was moving back to California. The hell with everything and everybody in this town. What a place to live. She wouldn't continue to live in this town if they gave her the place and six more like it. Within a day or two of deciding to move, she'd packed her things into boxes. That was last January. Or maybe it was February. Anyway, last winter sometime. Now it's the end of June. Boxes have been sitting around inside her house for months. You have to walk around them or step over them to get from one room to another. This is no way for anyone's mother to live. After a while, 10 minutes or so, Jill comes out of the bathroom. I've found a roach and I'm trying to smoke that and drink a bottle of ginger ale while I watch one of the neighbors change the oil in his car. Jill doesn't look at me. Instead, she goes into the kitchen and puts some plates and utensils into a paper sack. But when she comes back through the living room, I stand up and we hug each other. Jill says, "It's okay." What's okay, I wonder. As far as I can see, nothing's okay. But she holds me and keeps patting my shoulder. I can smell the pet shampoo on her. She comes home from work wearing the stuff. It's everywhere. Even when we're in bed together, she gives me a final pat. Then we go out to the car and drive across town to my mother's. I like where I live. I didn't when I first moved here. There was nothing to do at night, and I was lonely. Then I met Jill. Pretty soon, after a few weeks, she brought her things over and started living with me. We didn't set any long-term goals. We were happy, and we had a life together. We told each other we'd finally got lucky. But my mother didn't have anything going in her life. So she wrote me and said she'd decided on moving here. I wrote her back and said I didn't think it was such a good idea. "The weather's terrible in the winter," I said. "They're building a prison a few miles from town," I told her. "The place is bumper-to-bumper tourists all summer," I said. But she acted as if she never got my letters and came anyway. Then, after she'd been in town a little less than a month, she told me she hated the place. She acted as if it were my fault she'd moved here and my fault she found everything so disagreeable. She started calling me up and telling me how crummy the place was. "Lane guilt trips," Jill called it. She told me the bus service was terrible and the drivers unfriendly. As for the people at the senior citizens, well, she didn't want to play casino.
"They can go to hell," she said, "and take their card games with them."
The clerks at the supermarket were surly. The guys in the service station didn't give a damn about her or her car. And she'd made up her mind about the man she rented from, Larry Hadlock. King Larry, she called him.
"He thinks he's superior to everyone because he has some shacks for rent and a few dollars. I wish to God I'd never laid eyes on him."
It was too hot for her when she arrived, in August, and in September it started to rain. It rained almost every day for weeks. In October it turned cold. There was snow in November and December. But long before that, she began to put the bad mouth on the place and the people to the extent that I didn't want to hear about it anymore. And I told her so, finally. She cried, and I hugged her and thought that was the end of it. But a few days later, she started in again, same stuff. Just before Christmas, she called to see when I was coming by with her presents. She hadn't put up a tree and didn't intend to, she said. Then she said something else. She said if this weather didn't improve, she was going to kill herself. "Don't talk crazy," I said. She said,
"I mean it, honey. I don't want to see this place again except for my coffin. I hate this GD place. I don't know why I moved here. I wish I could just die and get it over with."
I remember hanging onto the phone and watching a man high up on a pole doing something to a power line. Snow whirled around his head. As I watched, he leaned out from the pole, supported only by his safety belt. "Suppose he falls," I thought. I didn't have any idea what I was going to say next. I had to say something. But I was filled with unworthy feelings, thoughts no son should admit to. "You're my mother," I said finally. "What can I do to help?"
"Honey, you can't do anything," she said. "The time for doing anything has come and gone. It's too late to do anything. I wanted to like it here. I thought we'd go on picnics and take drives together. But none of that happened. You're always busy. You're off working, you and Jill. You're never at home. Or else, if you are at home, you have the phone off the hook all day. Anyway, I never see you."
She said, "That's not true," I said. And it wasn't. But she went on as if she hadn't heard me. Maybe she hadn't.
"Besides,"
she said,
"this weather's killing me. It's too damned cold here. Why didn't you tell me this was the North Pole? If you had, I'd never have come. I want to go back to California, honey. I can get out and go places there. I don't know anywhere to go here. There are people back in California. I've got friends there who care what happens to me. Nobody gives a damn here. Well, I just pray I can get through to June. If I can make it that long, if I can last to June, I'm leaving this place forever. This is the worst place I've ever lived in."
What could I say? I didn't know what to say. I couldn't even say anything about the weather. Weather was a real sore point. We said goodbye and hung up. Other people take vacations in the summer, but my mother moves. She started moving years ago, after my dad lost his job. When that happened, when he was laid off, they sold their home as if this were what they should do, and went to where they thought things would be better. But things weren't any better there either. They moved again. They kept on moving. They lived in rented houses, apartments, mobile homes, and motel units even. They kept moving, lightening their load with each move they made. A couple of times they landed in a town where I lived. They'd move in with my wife and me for a while, and then they'd move on again. They were like migrating animals in this regard, except there was no pattern to their movement. They moved around for years, sometimes even leaving the state for what they thought would be greener pastures. But mostly they stayed in Northern California and did their moving there. Then my dad died, and I thought my mother would stop moving and stay in one place for a while. But she didn't. She kept moving. I suggested once that she go to a psychiatrist. I even said I'd pay for it. But she wouldn't hear of it. She packed and moved out of town instead. I was desperate about things, or I wouldn't have said that about the psychiatrist. She was always in the process of packing or else unpacking. Sometimes she'd move two or three times in the same year. She talked bitterly about the place she was leaving and optimistically about the place she was going to. Her mail got fouled up, her benefit checks went off somewhere else, and she spent hours writing letters, trying to get it all straightened out. Sometimes she'd move out of an apartment house, move to another one a few blocks away, and then, a month later, move back to the place she'd left, only to a different floor or a different side of the building. That's why when she moved here, I rented a house for her and saw to it that it was furnished to her liking.
Moving around keeps her alive, Jill said. It gives her something to do. She must get some kind of weird enjoyment out of it, I guess.
But enjoyment or not, Jill thinks my mother must be losing her mind. I think so, too. But how do you tell your mother this? How do you deal with her if this is the case? Crazy doesn't stop her from planning and getting on with her next move. She is waiting at the back door for us when we pull in. She's 70 years old, has gray hair, wears glasses with rhinestone frames, and has never been sick a day in her life. She hugs Jill, and then she hugs me. Her eyes are bright as if she's been drinking, but she doesn't drink. She quit years ago after my dad went on the wagon. We finish hugging and go inside. It's around 5 in the afternoon. I smell whatever it is drifting out of her kitchen and remember I haven't eaten since breakfast. My buzz has worn off. I'm starved, I say.
Something smells good, Jill says. I hope it tastes good, my mother says. I hope this chicken's done.
She raises the lid on a fry pan and pushes a fork into a chicken breast.
If there's anything I can't stand, it's raw chicken. I think it's done. Why don't you sit down? Sit any place. I still can't regulate my stove. The burners heat up too fast. I don't like electric stoves and never have. Move that junk off the chair, Jill. I'm living here like a damned gypsy. But not for much longer, I hope.
She sees me looking around for the ashtray.
Behind you, she says. On the windowsill, honey. Before you sit down, why don't you pour us some of that Pepsi? You'll have to use these paper cups. I should have told you to bring some glasses. Is the Pepsi cold? I don't have any ice. This ice box won't keep anything cold. It isn't worth a damn. My ice cream turns to soup. It's the worst ice box I've ever had.
She forks the chicken onto a plate and puts the plate on the table along with beans and coleslaw and white bread. Then she looks to see if there is anything she's forgetting. Salt and pepper.
Sit down, she says.
We draw our chairs up to the table and Jill takes the plates out of the sack and hands them around the table to us.
Where are you going to live when you go back? She says. Do you have a place lined up?
My mother passes the chicken to Jill and says,
I wrote that lady I rented from before. She wrote back and said she had a nice first floor place I could have. It's close to the bus stop and there's lots of stores in the area. There's a bank and a Safeway. It's the nicest place. I don't know why I left there.
She says that and helps herself to some coleslaw.
Why'd you leave then? Jill says. If it was so nice and all.
She picks up her drumstick, looks at it, and takes a bite of the meat.
I'll tell you why. There was an old alcoholic woman who lived next door to me. She drank from morning to night. The walls were so thin I could hear her munching ice cubes all day. She had to use a walker to get around, but that still didn't stop her. I'd hear that walker scrape, scrape against the floor from morning to night. That and her icebox door closing.
She shakes her head at all that she had to put up with.
I had to get out of there. Scrape, scrape, all day. I couldn't stand it. I just couldn't live like that. This time I told the manager I didn't want to be next to any alcoholics. And I didn't want anything on the second floor. The second floor looks out on the parking lot. Nothing to see from there.
She waits for Jill to say something more, but Jill doesn't comment. My mother looks over at me. I'm eating like a wolf and don't say anything either. In any case, there's nothing more to say on the subject. I keep chewing and look over at the boxes stacked against the fridge. Then I help myself to more coleslaw. Pretty soon I finish and push my chair back. Larry Hadlock pulls up in back of the house next to my car and takes a lawnmower out of his pickup. I watch him through the window behind the table. He doesn't look in our direction.
What's he want?
My mother says and stops eating. He's going to cut your grass, it looks like, I say.
It doesn't need cutting, she says. He cut it last week. What's there for him to cut?
It's for the new tenant, Jill says, whoever that turns out to be. My mother takes this in and then goes back to eating. Larry Hadlock starts his mower and begins to cut the grass. I know him a little. He lowered the rent 25 a month when I told him it was my mother. He is a widower, a big fellow, mid-60s. An unhappy man with a good sense of humor. His arms are covered with white hair, and white hair stands out from under his cap. He looks like a magazine illustration of a farmer. But he isn't a farmer. He is a retired construction worker who's saved a little money. For a while, in the beginning, I let myself imagine that he and my mother might take some meals together and become friends.
There's the king, my mother says. King Larry. Not everyone has as much money as he does and can live in a big house and charge other people high rents. Well, I hope I never see his cheap old face again once I live here. Eat the rest of this chicken,
she says to me. But I shake my head and light a cigarette. Larry pushes his mower past the window.
You won't have to look at it much longer,
Jill says.
I'm sure glad of that, Jill. But I know he won't give me my deposit back.
How do you know that? I say.
I just know, she says. I've had dealings with his kind before. They're out for all they can get.
Jill says,
it won't be long now and you won't have anything more to do with him. I'll be so glad. But it'll be somebody just like him,
Jill says.
I don't want to think that, Jill,
my mother says. She makes coffee while Jill clears the table. I rinse the cups. Then I pour coffee and we step around a box marked knickknacks and take our cups into the living room. Larry Hadlock is at the side of the house. Traffic moves slowly on the street out in front, and the sun has started down over the trees. I can hear the commotion the mower makes. Some crows leave the phone line and settle onto the newly cut grass in the front yard.
I'm going to miss you, honey,
my mother says. Then she says,
I'll miss you too, Jill. I'm going to miss both of you.
Jill sips from her coffee and nods. Then she says,
I hope you have a safe trip back and find the place you're looking for at the end of the road. When I get settled, and this is my last move, so help me, I hope you'll come and visit,
my mother says. She looks at me and waits to be reassured. We will, I say. But even as I say it, I know it isn't true. My life caved in on me down there, and I won't be going back.
I wish you could have been happier here, Jill says. I wish you'd have been able to stick it out or something. You know what? Your son is worried sick about you.
Jill, I say. But she gives her head a little shake and goes on.
Sometimes he can't sleep over it. He wakes up sometimes in the night and says, I can't sleep, I'm thinking about my mother. There,
she says and looks at me.
I've said it. But it was on my mind. How do you think I must feel?
My mother says. Then she says,
other women my age can be happy. Why can't I be like other women? All I want is a house and a town to live in that will make me happy. That isn't a crime, is it? I hope not. I hope I'm not asking too much out of life.
She puts her cup on the floor next to her chair and waits for Jill to tell her she isn't asking for too much. But Jill doesn't say anything, and in a minute my mother begins to outline her plans to be happy. After a time, Jill lowers her eyes to her cup and has some more coffee. I can tell she's stopped listening, but my mother keeps talking anyway. The crows work their way through the grass in the front yard. I hear the mower howl and then thud as it picks up a clump of grass in the blade and comes to a stop. In a minute, after several tries, Larry gets it going again. The crows fly off back to their wire. Jill picks at a fingernail. My mother is saying that the secondhand furniture dealer is coming around the next morning to collect the things she isn't going to send on the bus or carry with her in the car. The table and chairs, TV, sofa, and bed are going with the dealer. But he's told her he doesn't have any use for the card table, so my mother is going to throw it out unless we want it. We'll take it, I say. Jill looks over. She starts to say something but changes her mind. I will drive the boxes to the Greyhound station the next afternoon and start them on their way to California. My mother will spend the last night with us, as arranged. And then, early the next morning, 2 days from now, she'll be on her way. She continues to talk. She talks on and on as she describes the trip she is about to make. She'll drive until 4 o'clock in the afternoon and then take a motel room for the night. She figures to make Eugene by dark. Eugene is a nice town. She stayed there once before, on the way up here. When she leaves the motel, she'll leave at sunrise and should, if God is looking out for her, be in California that afternoon. And God is looking out for her, she knows he is. How else explain her being kept around on the face of the earth? He has a plan for her. She's been praying a lot lately. She's been praying for me, too.
Why are you praying for him?
Jill wants to know.
Because I feel like it. Because he's my son,
my mother says.
Is there anything the matter with that? Don't we all need praying for sometimes? Maybe some people don't. I don't know. What do I know anymore?
She brings a hand to her forehead and rearranges some hair that's come loose from a pin. The mower sputters off, and pretty soon we see Larry go around the house pulling the hose. He sets the hose out and then goes slowly back around the house to turn the water on. The sprinkler begins to turn. My mother starts listing the ways she imagines Larry has wronged her since she's been in the house. But now I'm not listening either. I am thinking how she is about to go down the highway again, and nobody can reason with her or do anything to stop her. What can I do? I can't tie her up or commit her, though it may come to that eventually. I worry for her, and she is a heartache to me. She is all the family I have left. I'm sorry she didn't like it here and wants to leave. But I'm never going back to California. And when that's clear to me, I understand something else, too. I understand that after she leaves, I'm probably never going to see her again. I look over at my mother. She stops talking. Jill raises her eyes. Both of them look at me.
What is it, honey?
My mother says.
What's wrong?
Jill says. I lean forward in the chair and cover my face with my hands. I sit like that for a minute, feeling bad and stupid for doing it, but I can't help it. And the woman who brought me into this life, and this other woman I picked up with less than a year ago, they exclaim together and rise and come over to where I sit with my head in my hands like a fool. I don't open my eyes. I listen to the sprinkler whipping the grass.
What's wrong? What's the matter?
They say. It's okay, I say. And in a minute it is. I open my eyes and bring my head up. I reach for a cigarette.
See what I mean?
Jill says.
You're driving him crazy. He's going crazy with worry over you.
She is on one side of my chair and my mother is on the other side. They could tear me apart in no time at all.
I wish I could die and get out of everyone's way,
my mother says quietly.
So help me, Hannah. I can't take much more of this.
How about some more coffee? I say. Maybe we ought to catch the news, I say. Then I guess Jill and I better head for home. 2 days later, early in the morning, I say goodbye to my mother for what may be the last time. I've let Jill sleep. It won't hurt if she's late to work for a change. The dogs can wait for their baths and trimmings and such. My mother holds my arm as I walk her down the steps to the driveway and open the car door for her. She is wearing white slacks and a white blouse and white sandals. Her hair is pulled back and tied with a scarf. That's white, too. It's going to be a nice day, and the sky is clear and already blue. On the front seat of the car, I see maps and a thermos of coffee. My mother looks at these things as if she can't recall having come outside with them just a few minutes ago. She turns to me then and says,
"Let me hug you once more. Let me love your neck. I know I won't see you for a long time."
She puts an arm around my neck, draws me to her, and then begins to cry. But she stops almost at once and steps back, pushing the heel of her hand against her eyes.
"I said I wouldn't do that, and I won't. But let me get a last look at you anyway. I'll miss you, honey,"
she says.
"I'm just going to have to live through this. I've already lived through things I didn't think were possible. But I'll live through this too, I guess."
She gets into the car, starts it, and runs the engine for a minute. She rolls her window down. "I'm going to miss you," I say. And I am going to miss her. She's my mother, after all, and why shouldn't I miss her? But God forgive me, I'm glad, too, that it's finally time and that she is leaving.
"Goodbye,"
she says.
"Tell Jill thanks for supper last night. Tell her I said goodbye."
"I will," I say. I stand there wanting to say something else, but I don't know what. We keep looking at each other, trying to smile and reassure each other. Then something comes into her eyes, and I believe she is thinking about the highway and how far she is going to have to drive that day. She takes her eyes off me and looks down the road. Then she rolls her window up, puts the car into gear, and drives to the intersection where she has to wait for the light to change. When I see she's made it into traffic and headed toward the highway, I go back in the house and drink some coffee. I feel sad for a while, and then the sadness goes away and I start thinking about other things. A few nights later, my mother calls to say she is in her new place. She is busy fixing it up the way she does when she has a new place. She tells me I'll be happy to know she likes it just fine to be back in sunny California. But she says there's something in the air where she is living, maybe it's pollen, that is causing her to sneeze a lot. And the traffic is heavier than she remembers from before. She doesn't recall there being so much traffic in her neighborhood. Naturally, everyone still drives like crazy down there.
"California drivers," she says. "What else can you expect?"
She says it's hot for this time of the year. She doesn't think the air conditioning unit in her apartment is working right. I tell her she should talk to the manager.
"She's never around when you need her,"
my mother says. She hopes she hasn't made a mistake in moving back to California. She waits before she says anything else. I'm standing at the window with the phone pressed to my ear, looking out at the lights from town and at the lighted houses closer by. Jill is at the table with the catalog, listening.
"Are you still there?"
my mother asks.
"I wish you'd say something."
I don't know why, but it's then I recall the affectionate name my dad used sometimes when he was talking nice to my mother. Those times, that is, when he wasn't drunk. It was a long time ago, and I was a kid, but always hearing it, I felt better, less afraid, more hopeful about the future. "Dear," he'd say. He called her Dear sometimes, a sweet name. "Dear," he'd say, "if you're going to the store, will you bring me some cigarettes?" Or, "Dear, is your cold any better?" "Dear, where is my coffee cup?" The word issues from my lips before I can think what else I want to say to go along with it. "Dear," I say it again. I call her Dear. "Dear, try not to be afraid," I say. I tell my mother I love her and I'll write to her, yes. Then I say goodbye and I hang up. For a while, I don't move from the window. I keep standing there, looking out at the lighted houses in our neighborhood. As I watch, a car turns off the road and pulls into a driveway. The porch light goes on. The door to the house opens and someone comes out on the porch and stands there waiting. Jill turns the pages of her catalog and then she stops turning them.
"This is what we want," she says. "This is more like what I had in mind. Look at this, will you?"
But I don't look. I don't care 5 cents for curtains.
"What is it you see out there, honey?"
Jill says.
"Tell me."
What's there to tell? The people over there embrace for a minute, and then they go inside the house together. They leave the light burning. Then they remember, and it goes out. Whoever was using this bed. The call comes in the middle of the night, 3 in the morning, and it nearly scares us to death.
Answer it, answer it, my wife cries. My God, who is it? Answer it.
I can't find the light, but I get to the other room where the phone is and I pick it up after the 4th ring.
Is Bud there?
This woman says, very drunk. Jesus, you have the wrong number, I say, and hang up. I turn the light on and go into the bathroom, and that's when I hear the phone start again.
Answer that,
my wife screams from the bedroom.
What in God's name do they want, Jack? I can't take any more.
I hurry out of the bathroom and pick up the phone.
Bud?
The woman says.
What are you doing, Bud?
I say, look here, you have a wrong number. Don't ever call this number again.
I have to talk to Bud,
she says. I hang up, wait until it rings again, and then I take the receiver and lay it on the table beside the phone. But I hear the woman's voice say,
Bud, talk to me, please.
I leave the receiver on its side on the table, turn off the light, and close the door to the room. In the bedroom, I find the lamp on and my wife, Iris, sitting against the headboard with her knees drawn up under the covers. She has a pillow behind her back, and she's more on my side than her own side. The covers are up around her shoulders. The blankets and the sheet have been pulled out from the foot of the bed. If we want to go back to sleep, I want to go back to sleep anyway. We may have to start from scratch and do this bed over again.
What the hell was that all about?
Iris says.
We should have unplugged the phone. I guess we forgot. Try forgetting one night to unplug the phone and see what happens. I don't believe it.
After Iris and I started living together, my former wife, or else one of my kids, used to call up when we were asleep and want to harangue us. They kept doing it, even after Iris and I were married. So we started unplugging our phone before we went to bed. We unplugged the phone every night of the year, just about. It was a habit. This time I slipped up, that's all. Some woman wanting Bud, I say. I'm standing there in my pajamas, wanting to get into bed, but I can't. She was drunk. Move over, honey. I took the phone off the hook.
She can't call again?
No, I say. Why don't you move over a little and give me some of those covers? She takes her pillow and puts it on the far side of the bed against the headboard, scoots over, and then she leans back once more. She doesn't look sleepy. She looks fully awake. I get into bed and take some covers, but the covers don't feel right. I don't have any sheet. All I have is blanket. I look down and see my feet sticking out. I turn onto my side facing her and bring my legs up so that my feet are under the blanket. We should make up the bed again. I ought to suggest that. But I'm thinking, too, that if we kill the light now, this minute, we might be able to go right back to sleep. How about you turning off your light, honey? I say as nice as I can.
Let's have a cigarette first, she says. Then we'll go to sleep. Get us the cigarettes in the ashtray, why don't you? We'll have a cigarette.
Let's go to sleep, I say. Look at what time it is. The clock radio is right there beside the bed. Anyone can see it says 3:30.
Come on, Iris says. I need a cigarette after all that.
I get out of bed for the cigarettes and ashtray. I have to go into the room where the phone is, but I don't touch the phone. I don't even want to look at the phone, but I do, of course. The receiver is still on its side on the table. I crawl back in bed and put the ashtray on the quilt between us. I light a cigarette, give it to her, and then light one for myself. She tries to remember the dream she was having when the phone rang.
I can just about remember it, but I can't remember exactly. Something about... No, I don't know what it was about now. I can't be sure. I can't remember it,
she says finally.
God damn that woman and her phone call.
Bud, she says.
I'd like to punch her.
She puts out her cigarette and immediately lights another, blows smoke, and lets her eyes take in the chest of drawers and the window curtains. Her hair is undone and around her shoulders. She uses the ashtray and then stares over the foot of the bed, trying to remember. But really, I don't care what she's dreamed. I want to go back to sleep is all. I finish my cigarette and put it out and wait for her to finish. I lie still and don't say anything. Iris is like my former wife in that when she sleeps, she sometimes has violent dreams. She thrashes around in bed during the night and wakes in the morning drenched with sweat, the nightgown sticking to her body. And, like my former wife, she wants to tell me her dreams in great detail and speculate as to what this stands for or that portends. My former wife used to kick the covers off in the night and cry out in her sleep as if someone were laying hands on her. Once, in a particularly violent dream, she hit me on the ear with her fist. I was in a dreamless sleep, but I struck out in the dark and hit her on the forehead. Then we began yelling. We both yelled and yelled. We'd hurt each other, but we were mainly scared. We had no idea what had happened until I turned the lamp on. Then we sorted it out. Afterward, we joked about it, fist fighting in our sleep. But then so much else began to happen that was far more serious, we tended to forget about that night. We never mentioned it again, even when we teased each other. Once I woke up in the night to hear Iris grinding her teeth in her sleep. It was such a peculiar thing to have going on right next to my ear that it woke me up. I gave her a little shake and she stopped. The next morning, she told me she'd had a very bad dream, but that's all she'd tell me about it. I didn't press her for details. I guess I really didn't want to know what could have been so bad that she didn't want to say. When I told her she'd been grinding her teeth in her sleep, she frowned and said she was going to have to do something about that. The next night, she brought home something called a night guard, something she was supposed to wear in her mouth while she slept. She had to do something, she said. She couldn't afford to keep grinding her teeth. Pretty soon she wouldn't have any. So she wore this protective device in her mouth for a week or so, and then she stopped wearing it. She said it was uncomfortable, and anyway, it was not very cosmetic. Who'd want to kiss a woman wearing a thing like that in her mouth, she said. She had something there, of course. Another time, I woke up because she was stroking my face and calling me Earl. I took her hand and squeezed her fingers. What is it? I said. What is it, sweetheart? But instead of answering, she simply squeezed back, sighed, and then lay still again. The next morning, when I asked her what she'd dreamed the night before, she claimed not to have had any dreams. So who's Earl? I said. Who is this Earl you were talking about in your sleep? She blushed and said she didn't know anybody named Earl and never had. The lamp is still on, and because I don't know what else to think about, I think about that phone being off the hook. I ought to hang it up and unplug the cord. Then we have to think about sleep. I'll go take care of that phone, I say. Then let's go to sleep. Iris uses the ashtray and says,
Make sure it's unplugged this time.
I get up again and go to the other room, open the door, and turn on the light. The receiver is still on its side on the table. I bring it to my ear, expecting to hear the dial tone, but I don't hear anything, not even the tone. On an impulse, I say something. Hello, I say.
Oh, but it's you, the woman says.
I hang up the phone and bend over and unplug it from the wall before it can ring again. This is a new one on me. This deal is a mystery, this woman and her bud person. I don't know how to tell Iris about this new development, because it'll just lead to more discussion and further speculation. I decide not to say anything for now. Maybe I'll say something over breakfast. Back in the bedroom, I see she is smoking another cigarette. I see, too, that it's nearly 4 in the morning. I'm starting to worry. When it's 4 o'clock, it'll soon be 5 o'clock, and then it will be 6, then 6:30, then time to get up for work. I lie back down, close my eyes, and decide I'll count to 60, slowly, before I say anything else about the light.
I'm starting to remember, Iris says. It's coming back to me. You want to hear it, Jack?
I stop counting, open my eyes, sit up. The bedroom is filled with smoke. I light one up, too. Why not? The hell with it. She says,
There was a party going on in my dream.
Where was I when this was going on? Usually, for whatever reason, I don't figure in her dreams. It irritates me a little, but I don't let on. My feet are uncovered again. I pull them under the covers, raise myself up on my elbow, and use the ashtray. Is this another dream that I'm not in? It's okay if that's the case. I pull on the cigarette. Hold the smoke, let it out. Honey, you weren't in the dream, Iris says. I'm sorry, but you weren't. You weren't anywhere around. I missed you, though. I did miss you, I'm sure of it. It was like I knew you were somewhere nearby, but you weren't there where I needed you. You know how I get into those anxiety states sometimes? If we go someplace together where there's a group of people and we get separated and I can't find you? It was a little like that. You were there, I think, but I couldn't find you.
Go ahead and tell me about the dream, I say. She rearranges the covers around her waist and legs and reaches for a cigarette. I hold the lighter for her. Then she goes on to describe this party where all that was being served was beer.
I don't even like beer, she says,
but she drank a large quantity anyway. And just when she went to leave, to go home, she says, this little dog took hold of the hem of her dress and made her stay. She laughs, and I laugh right along with her, even though, when I look at the clock, I see the hands are close to saying 4:30. There was some kind of music being played in her dream, a piano maybe, or else it was an accordion, who knows. Dreams are that way sometimes, she says. Anyway, she vaguely remembers her former husband putting in an appearance. He might have been the one serving the beer. People were drinking beer from a keg using plastic cups. She thought she might even have danced with him. Why are you telling me this? She says.
It was a dream, honey.
I don't think I like it, knowing you're supposed to be here beside me all night, but instead you're dreaming about strange dogs, parties, and ex-husbands. I don't like you dancing with him. What the hell is this? What if I told you I dreamed and danced the night away with Carol? Would you like it?
It's just a dream, right?
She says.
Don't get weird on me. I won't say any more. I see I can't. I can see it isn't a good idea.
She brings her fingers to her lips slowly, the way she does sometimes when she's thinking. Her face shows how hard she's concentrating. Little lines appear on her forehead.
I'm sorry that you weren't in the dream. But if I told you otherwise, I'd be lying to you, right?
I nod. I touch her arm to show her it's okay. I don't really mind. And I don't, I guess. What happened then, honey? Finish telling the dream, I say. And maybe we can go to sleep then. I guess I wanted to know the next thing. The last I'd heard, she'd been dancing with Jerry. If there was more, I needed to hear it. She plumps up the pillow behind her back and says,
That's all I can remember. I can't remember any more about it. That was when the goddamn phone rang.
Bud, I say. I can see smoke drifting in the light under the lamp, and smoke hangs in the air in the room. Maybe we should open a window, I say.
That's a good idea,
she says.
Let some of this smoke out. It can't be any good for us.
Hell no, it isn't, I say. I get up again and go to the window and raise it a few inches. I can feel the cool air that comes in from a distance. I hear a truck gearing down as it starts up the grade that will take it to the pass and on over into the next state.
I guess pretty soon we're going to be the last smokers left in America, she says. Seriously, we should think about quitting.
She says this as she puts her cigarette out and reaches for the pack next to the ashtray. It's open season on smokers, I say. I get back in the bed. The covers are turned every which way, and it's 5 o'clock in the morning. I don't think we're going to sleep anymore tonight. But so what if we don't? Is there a law in the books? Is something bad going to happen to us if we don't? She takes some of her hair between her fingers. Then she pushes it behind her ear, looks at me, and says,
Lately I've been feeling this vein in my forehead. It pulses sometimes. It throbs. Do you know what I'm talking about? I don't know if you've ever had anything like that. I hate to think about it, but probably one of these days I'll have a stroke or something. Isn't that how they happen? A vein in your head bursts? That's probably what'll happen to me eventually. My mother, my grandmother, and one of my aunts died of stroke. There's a history of stroke in my family. It can run in the family, you know. It's hereditary, just like heart disease or being too fat or whatever. Anyway, she says, something's going to happen to me someday, right? So maybe that's what it'll be, a stroke. Maybe that's how I'll go. That's what it feels like it could be the beginning of. First, it pulses a little,
Like it wants my attention, and then it starts to throb. Throb, throb, throb. It scares me silly,
she says.
I want us to give up these goddamn cigarettes before it's too late.
She looks at what's left of her cigarette, mashes it into the ashtray, and tries to fan the smoke away. I'm on my back, studying the ceiling, thinking that this is the kind of talk that could only take place at 5 in the morning. I feel I ought to say something. I get winded easy, I say. I found myself out of breath when I ran in there to answer the phone.
That could have been because of anxiety,
Iris says.
Who needs it anyway? The idea of somebody calling at this hour. I could tear that woman limb from limb.
I pull myself up in the bed and lean back against the headboard. I put the pillow behind my back and try to get comfortable, same as Iris. I'll tell you something I haven't told you, I say. Once in a while, my heart palpitates. It's like it goes crazy. She's watching me closely, listening for whatever it is I'm going to say next. Sometimes it feels like it's going to jump out of my chest. I don't know what the hell causes it.
Why didn't you tell me?
She says. She takes my hand and holds it. She squeezes my hand.
You never said anything, honey. Listen, I don't know what I'd do if something ever happened to you. I'd fold up. How often does it happen? That's scary, you know.
She's still holding my hand, but her fingers slide to my wrist where my pulse is. She goes on holding my wrist like this. I never told you because I didn't want to scare you, I say. But it happens sometimes. It happened as recently as a week ago. I don't have to be doing anything in particular when it happens either. I could be sitting in a chair with the paper, or else driving the car or pushing a grocery basket. It doesn't matter if I'm exerting myself or not. It just starts, boom, 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 like that. I'm surprised people can't hear it. It's that loud, I think. I can hear it anyway, and I don't mind telling you it scares me. I say. So if emphysema doesn't get me, or lung cancer, or maybe a stroke like what you're talking about, then it's going to be a heart attack, probably. I reach for the cigarette. I give her one. We're through with sleep for the night. Did we sleep? For a minute, I can't remember.
Who knows what we'll die of?
Iris says.
It could be anything. If we live long enough, maybe it'll be kidney failure or something like that. A friend of mine at work, her father just died of kidney failure. That's what can happen to you sometimes if you're lucky enough to get really old. When your kidneys fail, the body starts filling up with uric acid then. You finally turn a whole different color before you die.
Great. That sounds wonderful, I say. Maybe we should get off this subject. How'd we get onto this stuff anyway? She doesn't answer. She leans forward away from her pillow, arms clasping her legs. She closes her eyes and lays her head on her knees. Then she begins to rock back and forth, slowly. It's as if she were listening to music, but there isn't any music, none that I can hear anyway.
You know what I'd like?
She says. She stops moving, opens her eyes, and tilts her head at me. Then she grins, so I'll know she's all right. What would you like, honey? I've got my leg hooked over her leg at the ankle. She says,
I'd like some coffee, that's what. I could go for a nice strong cup of black coffee. We're awake, aren't we? Who's going back to sleep? Let's have some coffee.
We drink too much coffee, I say. All that coffee isn't good for us either. I'm not saying we shouldn't have any. I'm just saying we drink too much of it. It's just an observation, I add. Actually, I could drink some coffee myself.
Good,
she says. But neither of us makes a move. She shakes out her hair and then lights another cigarette. Smoke drifts slowly in the room. Some of it drifts toward the open window. A little rain begins to fall on the patio outside the window. The alarm comes on, and I reach over and shut it off. Then I take the pillow and put it under my head again. I lie back and stare at the ceiling some more. What happened to that bright idea we had about a girl who could bring us our coffee in bed? I say.
I wish somebody would bring us coffee, she says. A girl or a boy, one or the other. I could really go for some coffee right now.
She moves the ashtray to the nightstand, and I think she's going to get up. Somebody has to get up and start the coffee and put a can of frozen juice in the blender. One of us has to make a move. But what she does instead is slide down in the bed until she's sitting somewhere in the middle. The covers are all over the place. She picks at something on the quilt and then rubs her palm across whatever it is before she looks up.
Did you see in the paper where that guy took a shotgun into an intensive care unit and made the nurses take his father off the life support machine? Did you read about that?
Iris says. I saw something about it on the news, I say. But mostly they were talking about this nurse who unplugged 6 or 8 people from their machines. At this point, they don't know exactly how many she unplugged. She started off by unplugging her mother, and then she went on from there. It was like a spree, I guess. She said she thought she was doing everybody a favor. She said she hoped somebody'd do it for her, if they cared about her. Iris decides to move on down to the foot of the bed. She positions herself so that she is facing me. Her legs are still under the covers. She puts her legs between my legs and says,
What about that quadriplegic woman on the news who says she wants to die, wants to starve herself to death? Now she's suing her doctor and the hospital because they insist on force-feeding her to keep her alive. Can you believe it? It's insane. They strap her down 3 times a day so they can run this tube into her throat. They feed her breakfast, lunch, and dinner that way. And they keep her plugged into this machine, too, because her lungs don't want to work on their own. It said in the paper that she's begging them to unplug her, or else to just let her starve to death. She's having to plead with them to let her die, but they won't listen. She said she started out wanting to die with some dignity. Now she's just mad and looking to sue everybody. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that one for the books?
She says.
I have these headaches sometimes, she says. Maybe it has something to do with the vein. Maybe not. Maybe they're not related. But I don't tell you when my head hurts because I don't want to worry you.
What are you talking about? I say. Look at me. Iris, I have a right to know. I'm your husband, in case you've forgotten. If something's wrong with you, I should know about it.
But what could you do? You'd just worry.
She bumps my leg with her leg, then bumps it again.
Right? You'd tell me to take some aspirin. I know you.
I look toward the window, where it's beginning to get light. I can feel a damp breeze from the window. It's stopped raining now, but it's one of those mornings where it could begin to pour. I look at her again. To tell you the truth, Iris, I get sharp pains in my side from time to time. But the moment I say the words, I'm sorry. She'll be concerned and want to talk about it. We ought to be thinking of showers. We should be sitting down to breakfast.
Which side?
She says. Right side.
It could be your appendix,
she says.
Something fairly simple like that.
I shrug. Who knows? I don't know. All I know is it happens. Every so often, for just a minute or two, I feel something sharp down there. Very sharp. At first, I thought it might be a pulled muscle. Which side your gallbladder on, by the way? Is it the left or right side? Maybe it's my gallbladder. Or else maybe a gallstone, whatever the hell that is.
It's not really a stone,
she says.
A gallstone is like a little granule or something like that. It's about as big as the tip of a pencil. No, wait, that might be a kidney stone I'm talking about. I guess I don't know anything about it.
She shakes her head. What's the difference between kidney stone and gallstone? I say. Christ, we don't even know which side of the body they're on. You don't know and I don't know. That's how much we know together. A total of nothing. But I read somewhere that you can pass a kidney stone, if that's what this is, and usually it won't kill you. Painful, yes. I don't know what they say about a gallstone. I like that usually, she says. I know, I say. Listen, we'd better get up. It's getting really late. It's 7 o'clock.
I know,
she says.
Okay.
But she continues to sit there. Then she says,
My grandma had arthritis so bad toward the end, she couldn't get around by herself or even move her fingers. She had to sit in a chair and wear these mittens all day. Finally, she couldn't even hold a cup of cocoa. That's how bad her arthritis was. Then she had her stroke. And my grandpa,
she says.
He went into a nursing home not long after Grandma died. It was either that or else somebody had to come in and be with him around the clock, and nobody could do that. Nobody had the money for 24-hour-a-day care either. So he goes into the nursing home. But he began to deteriorate fast in there. One time, after he'd been in that place for a while, my mom went to visit him, and then she came home and said something. I'll never forget what she said.
She looks at me as if I'm never going to forget it either. And I'm not.
She said, "My dad doesn't recognize me anymore. He doesn't even know who I am. My dad has become a vegetable." That was my mom who said that.
She leans over and covers her face with her hands and begins to cry. I move down there to the foot of the bed and sit beside her. I take her hand and hold it in my lap. I put my arm around her. We're sitting together looking at the headboard and at the nightstand. The clock's there, too, and beside the clock, a few magazines and a paperback. We're sitting on the part of the bed where we keep our feet when we sleep. It looks like whoever was using this bed left in a hurry. I know I won't ever look at this bed again without remembering it like this. We're into something now, but I don't know what exactly.
I don't want anything like that to ever happen to me,
she says.
Or do you either?
She wipes her face with a corner of the blanket and takes a deep breath, which comes out as a sob.
I'm sorry. I just can't help it,
she says. It won't happen to us. It won't, I say. Don't worry about any of it, okay? We're fine, Iris, and we're going to stay fine. In any case, that time's a long time off. Hey, I love you. We love each other, don't we? That's the important thing. That's what counts. Don't worry, honey.
I want you to promise me something, she says.
She takes her hand back. She moves my arm away from her shoulder.
I want you to promise me you'll pull the plug on me if and when it's ever necessary. If it ever comes to that, I mean. Do you hear what I'm saying? I'm serious about this, Jack. I want you to pull the plug on me if you ever have to. Will you promise?
I don't say anything right away. What am I supposed to say? They haven't written a book on this one yet. I need a minute to think. I know it won't cost me anything to tell her I'll do whatever she wants. It's just words, right? Words are easy. But there's more to it than this. She wants an honest response from me. And I don't know what I feel about it yet. I shouldn't be hasty. I can't say something without thinking about what I'm saying, about consequences, about what she's going to feel when I say it, whatever it is I say. I'm still thinking about it when she says,
"What about you?"
What about me what?
Do you want to be unplugged if it comes to that? God forbid it ever does, of course,
she says.
But I should have some kind of idea, you know, some word from you now. About what you want me to do if worst comes to worst.
She's looking at me closely, waiting for me to say. She wants something she can file away to use later, if and when she ever has to. Sure, okay. Easy enough for me to say, unplug me, honey, if you think it's for the best. But I need to consider this a little more. I haven't even said yet what I will or won't do for her. Now I have to think about me and my situation. I don't feel I should jump into this. This is nuts. We're nuts. But I realize that whatever I say now might come back to me sometime. It's important. This is a life and death thing we're talking about here. She hasn't moved. She's still waiting for her answer. And I can see we're not going anywhere this morning until she has an answer. I think about it some more, and then I say what I mean. No. Don't unplug me. I don't want to be unplugged. Leave me hooked up just as long as possible. Who's going to object? Are you going to object? Will I be offending anybody? As long as people can stand the sight of me, just so long as they don't start howling, don't unplug anything. Let me keep going, okay? Right to the bitter end. Invite my friends in to say goodbye. Don't do anything rash.
Be serious, she says. This is a very serious matter we're discussing.
I am serious. Don't unplug me. It's as simple as that. She nods.
Okay, then. I promise you I won't.
She hugs me. She holds me tight for a minute. Then she lets me go. She looks at the clock radio and says,
Jesus, we better get moving.
So we get out of bed and start getting dressed. In some ways, it's just like any other morning, except we do things faster. We drink coffee and juice and we eat English muffins. We remark on the weather, which is overcast and blustery. We don't talk anymore about plugs or about sickness and hospitals and stuff like that. I kiss her and leave her on the front porch with her umbrella open, waiting for her ride to work. Then I hurry to my car and get in. In a minute, after I've run the motor, I wave and drive off. But during the day at work, I think about some of those things we talked about this morning. I can't help it. For one thing, I'm bone tired from lack of sleep. I feel vulnerable and prey to any random, gruesome thought. Once, when nobody is around, I put my head on my desk and think I might catch a few minutes' sleep. But when I close my eyes, I find myself thinking about it again. In my mind, I can see a hospital bed. That's all. Just a hospital bed. The bed's in a room, I guess. Then I see an oxygen tent over the bed, and beside the bed, some of those screens and some big monitors, the kind they have in movies. I open my eyes and sit up in my chair and light a cigarette. I drink some coffee while I smoke the cigarette. Then I look at the time and get back to work. At 5 o'clock, I'm so tired it's all I can do to drive home. It's raining, and I have to be careful driving. Very careful. There's been an accident, too. Someone has rear-ended someone else at a traffic light, but I don't think anyone has been hurt. The cars are still out in the road, and people are standing around in the rain talking. Still, traffic moves slowly. The police have set out flares. When I see my wife, I say, God, what a day. I'm whipped. How are you doing? We kiss each other. I take off my coat and hang it up. I take the drink Iris gives me. Then, because it's been on my mind, and because I want to clear the deck, so to speak, I say, All right, if it's what you want to hear, I'll pull the plug for you. If that's what you want me to do, I'll do it. If it will make you happy here and now to hear me say so, I'll say it. I'll do it for you. I'll pull the plug or have it pulled if I ever think it's necessary. But what I said about my plug still stands. Now, I don't want to have to think about this stuff ever again. I don't even want to have to talk about it again. I think we've said all there is to say on the subject. We've exhausted every angle. I'm exhausted. Iris grins.
Okay, she says. At least I know now, anyway. I didn't before. Maybe I'm crazy, but I feel better somehow, if you want to know. I don't want to think about it anymore, either. But I'm glad we talked it over. I'll never bring it up again, either, and that's a promise.
She takes my drink and puts it on the table next to the phone. She puts her arms around me and holds me and lets her head rest on my shoulder. But here's the thing. What I've just said to her, what I've been thinking about off and on all day, well, I feel as if I've crossed some kind of invisible line. I feel as if I've come to a place I never thought I'd have to come to. And I don't know how I got here. It's a strange place. It's a place where a little harmless dreaming and then some sleepy early morning talk has led me into considerations of death and annihilation. The phone rings. We let go of each other and I reach to answer it. Hello, I say.
Hello there,
the woman says back. It's the same woman who called this morning, but she isn't drunk now. At least I don't think she is. She doesn't sound drunk. She's speaking quietly, reasonably, and she is asking me if I can put her in touch with Bud Roberts. She apologizes. She hates to trouble me, she says, but this is an urgent matter. She's sorry for any trouble she might be giving. While she talks, I fumble with my cigarettes. I put one in my mouth and use the lighter. Then it's my turn to talk. This is what I say to her. Bud Roberts doesn't live here. He is not at this number, and I don't expect he ever will be. I will never, never lay eyes on this man you're talking about. Please don't ever call here again. Just don't, okay? Do you hear me? If you're not careful, I'll wring your neck for you.
The gall of that woman,
Iris says. My hands are shaking. I think my voice is doing things. But while I'm trying to tell all this to the woman, while I'm trying to make myself understood, my wife moves quickly and bends over, and that's it. The line goes dead, and I can't hear anything. Intimacy. I have some business out west anyway, so I stop off in this little town where my former wife lives. We haven't seen each other in 4 years. But from time to time, when something of mine appeared or was written about me in the magazines or papers, a profile or an interview, I sent her these things. I don't know what I had in mind, except I thought she might be interested. In any case, she never responded. It is 9 in the morning. I haven't called, and it's true I don't know what I am going to find. But she lets me in. She doesn't seem surprised. We don't shake hands, much less kiss each other. She takes me into the living room. As soon as I sit down, she brings me some coffee. Then she comes out with what's on her mind. She says I've caused her anguish, made her feel exposed and humiliated. Make no mistake, I feel I'm home. She says, but then you were into betrayal early. You always felt comfortable with betrayal. No, she says, that's not true, not in the beginning at any rate. You were different then. But I guess I was different, too. Everything was different, she says. No, it was after you turned 35 or 36, whenever it was, around in there anyway, your mid-30s somewhere, then you started in. You really started in. You turned on me. You did it up pretty then. You must be proud of yourself. She says, sometimes I could scream. She says she wishes I'd forget about the hard times, the bad times, when I talk about back then. Spend some time on the good times, she says. Weren't there some good times? She wishes I'd get off that other subject. She's bored with it, sick of hearing about it. Your private hobby horse, she says. What's done is done and water under the bridge, she says. A tragedy, yes. God knows it was a tragedy and then some. But why keep it going? Don't you ever get tired of dredging up that old business? She says let go of the past, for Christ's sake. Those old hurts. You must have some other arrows in your quiver, she says. She says, you know something? I think you're sick. I think you're crazy as a bedbug. Hey, you don't believe the things they're saying about you, do you? Don't believe them for a minute, she says. Listen, I could tell them a thing or two. Let them talk to me about it if they want to hear a story. She says, are you listening to me? I'm listening, I say. I'm all ears, I say. She says, I've really had a belly full of it, Buster. Who asked you here today anyway? I sure as hell didn't. You just show up and walk in. What the hell do you want from me? Blood? You want more blood? I thought you had your fill by now. She says, think of me as dead. I want to be left in peace now. That's all I want anymore, is to be left in peace and forgotten about. Hey, I'm 45 years old, she says. 45 going on 55 or 65. Lay off, will you? She says, why don't you wipe the blackboard clean and see what you have left after that? Why don't you start with a clean slate? See how far that gets you, she says. She has to laugh at this. I laugh too, but it's nerves. She says, you know something? I had my chance once, but I let it go. I just let it go. I don't guess I ever told you. But now look at me. Look. Take a good look while you're at it. You threw me away, you son of a bitch. She says, I was younger then and a better person. Maybe you were too, she says. A better person, I mean. You had to be. You were better then, or I wouldn't have had anything to do with you. She says, I loved you so much once. I loved you to the point of distraction. I did. More than anything in the whole wide world. Imagine that. What a laugh that is now. Can you imagine it? We were so intimate once upon a time, I can't believe it now. I think that's the strangest thing of all now. The memory of being that intimate with somebody. We were so intimate, I could puke. I can't imagine ever being that intimate with somebody else. I haven't been. She says, frankly, and I mean this, I want to be kept out of it from here on out. Who do you think you are anyway? You think you're God or somebody? You're not fit to lick God's boots or anybody else's for that matter. Mister, you've been hanging out with the wrong people. But what do I know? I don't even know what I know any longer. I know I don't like what you've been dishing out. I know that much. You know what I'm talking about, don't you? Am I right? Right, I say. Right as rain.
She says you'll agree to anything, won't you? You give in too easy. You always did. You don't have any principles, not one. Anything to avoid a fuss. But that's neither here nor there. She says, you remember that time I pulled the knife on you? She says this as if in passing, as if it's not important. Vaguely, I say. I must have deserved it, but I don't remember much about it. Go ahead, why don't you, and tell me about it. She says, I'm beginning to understand something now. I think I know why you're here. Yes, I know why you're here, even if you don't. But you're a sly boots. You know why you're here. You're on a fishing expedition. You're hunting for material. Am I getting warm? Am I right? Tell me about the knife, I say. She says, if you want to know, I'm real sorry I didn't use that knife. I am. I really and truly am. I've thought and thought about it, and I'm sorry I didn't use it. I had the chance, but I hesitated. I hesitated and was lost, as somebody or other said. But I should have used it, the hell with everything and everybody. I should have nicked your arm with it, at least. At least that. Well, you didn't, I say. I thought you were going to cut me with it, but you didn't. I took it away from you. She says, you were always lucky. You took it away and then you slapped me. Still, I regret I didn't use that knife just a little bit. Even a little would have been something to remember me by. I remember a lot, I say. I say that, then wish I hadn't. She says, amen, brother. That's the bone of contention here, if you hadn't noticed. That's the whole problem. But like I said, in my opinion, you remember the wrong things. You remember the low, shameful things. That's why you got interested when I brought up the knife. She says, I wonder if you ever have any regret. For whatever that's worth on the market these days, not much, I guess. But you ought to be a specialist in it by now. Regret, I say. It doesn't interest me much, to tell the truth. Regret is not a word I use very often. I guess I mainly don't have it. I admit I hold to the dark view of things, sometimes anyway. But regret? I don't think so.